Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. There's a line in a song that Lou Reed wrote. It goes, "There's only one good use for a small town. You hate it, and you know you'll have to leave." He wrote it about Andy Warhol, who famously left Pittsburgh for New York. But to Lou Reed, it applies universally. Small towns build character. That's about it. He's suggesting that if you're a weird, artsy kid, you need to get out of Dodge. You can't make meaningful art, you can't really be yourself unless you're in a big city with other weirdos like you. Our next guest, Bridget Everett, is a comedian and singer. She grew up in a small town, Manhattan, Kansas. She went to college in Arizona, then landed in New York City. She started singing in clubs, then eventually formed a sort of comedy cabaret act. On stage, she is hilarious and very bawdy, but also, boy howdy, can she blow. Bridget Everett also stars on the wonderful show Somebody Somewhere. It is a quiet and gentle comedy set in the same Manhattan, Kansas, where Bridget grew up. She plays Sam on the show. Like Bridget, Sam is funny. Like Bridget, Sam can sing. But unlike Bridget, Sam stays put in Kansas. Instead of fantasizing about leaving home, she finds her people. She starts singing in front of crowds for the first time in forever. And she keeps close to her family, which, as you might guess, is a mixed blessing. It's a really wonderful show. It is funny and heart-aching. It's just, and she's so great in it. I was really excited to interview Bridget Everett before I got jury duty. So, our thanks to our correspondent, Jordan Cruciola, who filled in for me. She is a writer who has covered film for Vulture and Inverse, among others. She also hosts the terrific Maximum Fun show, Feeling Seen. On that show, guests dive deep into the first time they felt they really saw themselves on screen. So, Bridget Everett, let's kick things off with a clip from Somebody Somewhere, which just kicked off its second season on HBO. As I said, part of the arc of the show is Sam rediscovering her singing voice. It is a way for her to find community, a way to deal with the loss of her sister, and really just a way to let loose. In the second season of the show, Sam starts seeing a vocal coach. In this scene, Sam's talking with her best friend Joel about a particular moment from her last lesson.
She said, "Remember this feeling? It's like the first time you fell in love."
"Well, that's a good feeling, right?"
"I don't know. I mean, I don't know."
"You've never been in love?"
"No, why would I do that to myself?"
"Well, do you want to change that?"
"No. I'd rather just sit around judging people that choose love and lose."
"Maybe we could join a dating site together."
"Oh, absolutely not. That's disgusting." "Besides, you're the only person I know that would do anything for me. Like stand guard for me on the side of the road when I gotta take a TT."
Oh my. Bridget Everett, welcome to Bullseye.
Thank you. Welcome to me and to you. And here we are. And wow, you guys start off with a real, you go right for the heart, right from the start.
Yeah. And we are going right for the heart of it. It like sets up two questions in my mind. So we'll just go ambitiously with the first one, which is, are you too reticent to welcome love into your life? Or do you have more of a receptive heart to that than Sam does?
If you can believe it, I'm even more closed off than Sam.
Okay. I've read a bit like in interviews with you where you talk about like sort of learning from Sam. And you're like, she's like a mess in her own right. But like, you know, I remember one quote reading you, I think it was an interview with The Playlist where you talked about her being brave. And you'd be like, and she's not even that brave, but she is brave in these ways that I find like sort of aspirational. And how has it been now? You're two seasons deep into playing this character. How were you influencing each other?
I think that, like, while Sam is shut off and while she moves at a much slower clip than a lot of society, mm-hmm. she definitely, you know, it's TV, so she's got to make some progress, right? Otherwise, yeah. I mean, if it was a story about Bridget Everett, you'd roll the cameras in, you know, cut to her on the couch, cut to her getting up to go to the refrigerator, get a glass of wine, cut to her coming back to the couch, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. cut to her taking her dog for a walk, and cut back to the couch. But, you know,
relatable content.
Yeah, relatable content, but boring. Look, I relate to a lot of the things that Sam feels, and the themes are very similar, obviously. And a lot of them come from, like, sort of some sort of, like, emotional tripwires for me, you know, which is the whole love thing. But Sam is scared, but she does make progress kind of inch by inch, mm-hmm. But only because of the people around her. Mm-hmm. Only because of, like, when you meet somebody like Joel, who's so open and love, but she feels very safe with him, it kind of gives her permission to just try a little bit harder and, mm-hmm. and push herself. But for me, I'd rather not.
Well, I'm glad you're getting the surrogate catharsis. I feel like that's a vital component.
That's such a good way to put it, surrogate catharsis.
Yeah, it's like you get to dip your toe into it, being like, is this for me?
Yeah.
Is this for me?
And immediately, once I start saying the words of Sam, I'm like, no, it's not. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to be somebody in your 40s.
Yeah.
I mean, I just turned 50, but just kind of waking up to, in season two more so, to kind of, what your shirt says, to live and die in LA, but to live, you know, she's to live, you know, uh-huh. she's living. And, but small steps. And Joel, you know, and the people around her are a little more awake, aware, and in full swing. So I don't know that I sort of got off topic for your question, but you know, no, we're doing the best I can.
We're following the tributaries off the river. We're just seeing where they take us to different parts of unknown, uncharted lands.
Yeah.
And this is like, this gets me into this question sooner than I thought I would be asking it. But with this clip and then talking about, like, you know, Sam finding love in community, the thing that never fails to just wrap me up the most about this show is the central sort of love story of it is really Sam and Joel.
Yeah.
And this is anybody who listens to Feeling Seen will hear me say all the time, like, I am a panromantic gray asexual person. My love stories are the friends in my life.
Yeah.
Like, those are the great romances that I have. That's where it all goes.
Yeah.
And so when I get to watch something where friendships are posited as, like, the central thing around which sort of, like, all love and community revolves, and it's not demoted in the hierarchy as, like, just friends compared to the, you know, the nomenclature of a significant other, that's a really gorgeous thing. And so I wanted to hear from you about, like, as you get further into the show and, you know, top of the call sheet, I've you know, read you, like, that's the threshold that you've hit with this on an HBO program. I wanted to talk to you about that aspect of love and community within the show and the chosen family part of it.
Well, you really put that so much better than I ever could. But that is the thing, right? It's like, for me, romantic relationships are not the central part of my life.
Yeah.
It's friendships. Those are the things that have changed me. And sometimes that can make me feel a little bit like an outsider, right? Because, you know, it's everybody around me finds love, has love, is in a relationship, and it's just not been what has sustained me. Mm-hmm. Or, and sometimes I almost feel a little embarrassed by that, you know, within my friend group, because I'm like, this is a thing that has value for me. And everybody's like, well, I have my person and I have my person and I have my emergency contact and those things. And I feel like Sam's story is different and it's similar to mine.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Joel reminds me a lot of two very significant friendships in my life. One of them is my friend, Zach Schaefer, who's my, you know, one of my first friends I met in New York, one of my best friends, and Mary Catherine, who plays my sister, Trisha. You know, we were roommates for many years. And friends have always kind of been my thing. And that's great. But then, you know, maybe they all go home to somebody else and I don't. And that, I don't know how to explain it, but it feels a little isolating in a way. It's like the sort of guiding light in your life or your friends. And that's what I want to do in the show. And I know, you know, the other executive producers, it's like that friendship is, those are the ones that save you and lift you. And that can be your great love story. And like, I'm kind of giving myself permission to feel that way, but other people to feel that way. And so when Sam, you know, because, you know, when I met my friend Zach and when I met Mary Catherine, I was like very kind of shut down and, you know, had a lot of friends, but not with the depth I wanted.
Yeah.
But not with any, I wasn't really willing to do the work necessarily. But both Zach and Mary Catherine just were like, no, you're going to do the work. You know, we're, because we see your value and we want that from you too. Right. And so they kind of broke me down brick by brick. And I feel like that's what Joel does for Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the season, they're sort of wrapped up in each other's world, right? And he's single now, she's single, and they're kind of each other's person.
Yeah.
But it never really stays that way. Yeah.
Well, and it's hard to be like, boy, we're just going to stick with this for a minute because I'm going to. It's a fascinating dynamic to be somebody's primary companion in a platonic way that reaches an intimate level of romantic connection.
Yeah.
And then when you are somebody who is aligned that way, such as myself, there is, in the most sort of like, I guess, cruel way of saying it, there comes an expiration date.
Yeah.
When that other person is not on the exact same page as you, because a romantic sexual partnership is something that like they desire in their life that will then sort of take the place of the intimacy that you share in a platonic connection.
Yeah.
And you have to just sort of get used to the fact that the rhythm of your life can revolve around that periodic sense of loss.
Yeah.
Even as you maintain those friendships and those intimate connections, it's like, oh, but right. That doesn't get to go forever. So you become sort of, I feel like one becomes accustomed to that cycle. And to watch a character, watching this show, I just want to thank you so much for like the permission that a narrative like this gives to people like me and you, who don't get a lot of avatars in storytelling for like, as an ace person, like, you know, that's kind of a neat and tidy way to align. But like, as a non-asexual person like yourself, that can still be true. That your friendship can be like your epic romances of your life. And it's nice to see something that's like, wow, this is truly reflective of an experience of so many people that I think we lack a language around that kind of intimacy that lets people know like, hey, intimacy is a bigger thing than we allow in a binary heteronormative way for understanding of most of the time. But guess what, guys, we have options for how we can let people into our lives and love them deeply.
Yeah. And I think that that's, it's sort of weird. I've never really like stopped and thought about it. Like I know when like we're writing the scripts and some of the stuff that like Sam says is like what I wish I could say or what I wish I could do. There's a scene, like, I don't want to give anything away, but like where sort of Sam and Joel finally have it out. And there's something that Sam says. It's like, you know, you kind of want things to remain in that kind of friendship honeymoon period forever, and acknowledging how it might not be that way, and that can be painful for both parties.
Yes.
You know, and I think that Sam is somebody who struggles with kind of only seeing things through her own lens. Mm-hmm. And Joel and Trisha are really instrumental in letting her know that there's other ways of looking at things.
Yeah.
Stick around. More Bullseye around the corner from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, our guest is Bridget Everett. She is a comedian and singer. She's also the star of Somebody Somewhere, a semi-autobiographical comedy, the second season of which is airing now on HBO.
I feel like the story of Bridget Everett is so much like the story of the relationships you have amassed along the way to make your work and to thrive. Like,
yeah.
You were talking about friends that you have that are in the show. Like, it sounds like during filming, at least of season one, you lived with, what was it, the Ding Dong Dorm,
yeah,
with Murray Hill and Jeff Hiller. And obviously with your group, The Tender Moments, you know, you have Ad-Rock in there from Beastie Boys. There's, you know, the connection you made with Amy Schumer. And you have such this, like, beautiful mosaic of people who you have built up throughout your career to put you in this position where, like, oh, yeah, I feel like you could walk into any room in New York City and be like, Bridget Everett. People are like, oh, yeah, I love Bridget.
Yeah,
and
just, I'm like a Kevin Bacon of New York City,
Yeah. And I wanted to hear from you about, like, that real life role of community in your life and getting you. Like you said, you're in your 50s now and you're in your second season of an HBO show that you're top lining and the people carrying you through to get you there.
Well, first of all, I do feel very fortunate. Like a lot of the people I've met along the way have kind of like lifted me up, and you're like, why are you helping me? And they're like, you know, but that's what people do, mm-hmm. You know, like when you're like on the bottom for so long, scrapping, you don't always think about lifting other people up. I mean, now I'm in the position to do that a little more than I was in the day, but I realize the value of that. But this is sort of a first of all those people are married that mm-hmm. you just talked about, and I've had sort of a friendship romance with a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
With all of them, really. Met, fell in love as friends.
Yeah.
You
oh,
know?
No. I am a serial fall in love with friends
I
person.
Think I am
I'm
too.
A serial monogamist of falling in love with
yeah.
friends. I'm currently falling in love in a new friendship right now, and it's absolutely the best thing in the world.
Yeah.
Because that's my favorite thing to do.
Yeah. It's great. But in some ways, I think it's like I started to feel along the way, it's like friends with everybody, but friends with no one, in a way. Like,
sure.
You know, like, not necessarily that sort of grand of a statement, but, like, once I sort of got a taste of, like, falling in love with a friend, like, and how intoxicating that was.
Like, cosign!
I wanted to do it again and again, but, mm-hmm. like, when they start sort of going off in their relationships,
indeed.
You just sort of feel like you're at sea a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the network of people that you're talking about, it's... I sometimes think, I'm like, how did I end up with so many special people in my life?
Well, okay. So then getting to that notion of community,
mm-hmm.
like the show it's not biographical, but it is like, it's like Bridget Everett-ish. It seems like kind of the story of Sam is a story of Bridget Everett-ish. There are echoes there.
Yeah.
And like starting your own life in Kansas and coming up, you know, going through, I think it was a scholarship to ASU for opera.
Yeah,
and
vocal performance.
Yes, yes. awestruck by that. And then working in New York City for years and building this sort of, it seems like you've really carved your own path specifically. Like, you have made a career out of your assets and talents and personality and persona in a way that it was like, well, if it wasn't ready made for me, I'm going to make it myself.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear about, like, when did you start? Was it always a practice for you, even when you were young and starting out in Kansas, to form that sort of chosen family around you? Or was that something in adulthood where you were like, no, I've got to build my community in this way?
I think it's when I got to New York. It happened because it's very unlike me. Like, I went to Arizona State because I was like, oh, I got a nice scholarship here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can be in a swimsuit. I can mm-hmm. lay by the pool.
Yeah, you were a very competitive swimmer in
yeah,
high school, correct?
I swam, you know, competitively there for a year, but, you know, I did it. And, you know, I did all the sort of things like the partying and this, that, and the other. But I just, and I have friends there, but when I moved to New York, it was like, I just was like, well, you know, Debbie Harry lived there and I love Debbie Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Barry yeah. Manilow, Bette Midler, you know, back in the bathhouses, there might be something there for me. So I just went.
Yeah.
And with no plan,
mm-hmm.
no whatever. I was like, well, I can, you know, I can wait tables. I can make some money.
Yeah.
But there's never been any plan for me. There's never been any whatever, because I just didn't see anybody kind of, not just that looked like me, but sort of the persona, the kind of, you know, post-athletic build, you know, almost 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to equity calls to try to get, you know, I wasn't a showgirl. Mm-hmm. I wasn't meant for TV. You know, I didn't have like the TV body face build.
Yeah.
Any of it. So, yeah. So I think maybe Bette Midler is kind of the closest person to designing your own destiny in the, in the I related to. But then I met, you know, Murray Hill, and I met Sweetie, a very influential drag queen to me, who's since passed away, Kiki and Herb, and a lot of different performers. And I was like, oh my God, these are my people. But I also felt like this is what I've been looking for my whole life.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And if I hadn't have just moved here for whatever reason, chasing Debbie Harry, you know, like
a great thing to chase,
you know, and seeing Hedwig off Broadway and like all these kind of things. I was like, oh my God. And my friend Zach taking me to the squeeze box parties and like all these, it was just a very vital, alive scene. And I was like, I always felt like kind of too big, too much, too loud. I always got in trouble for my mouth and dirty jokes. And then moving to a place where that was like an asset and not like a liability. And because I moved to New York and because I found places like Ars Nova and Joe's Pub, which are theaters that, you know, sort of Ars Nova is a place for emerging artists. And my friend Jason Egan saw me at a karaoke bar. He's like, you should do a show. And like just kind of having people see me along the way. You should do this. You should do this. Mm-hmm. Never like I did not have a roadmap. I did not sit down and be like, well, I want to do The Tonight Show by year 2007. Yeah. I want to play this club. I want to do that. Everything's just been like, OK, I'll do that. Yeah. Okay. And then
I feel like you hear that from first time filmmakers all the time, like that come out with like that surprise out of the gate, at, like Sundance or TIFF or something like that.
Yeah.
And they're like, we didn't know we weren't supposed to do it that way. And there's such an amazing freedom to that rawness of not knowing what you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
So you're just going to do it anyway.
Well, in a way, this show is kind of like that, too, except we had like the very steady, wise hand of Carolyn Strauss, who's one of our executive producers now. She's done Game of Thrones, Last of Us, Sopranos, like a lot of things. But she sort of has an exacting eye and like kind of always is like, more of you, more of you, more of you. And it's like, these people are very smart. Like, I'm going to...
Famously smart HBO.
But, you know, HBO came to see me, you know, a lot of people came to see me, like, when I play L.A. at Largo or when I play New York Joe's Pub. And, oh, we love you. We don't know what to do with you. So, anyway, HBO has kind of stuck with me.
Yeah.
And, like, really put their money where their mouth was and really have just kind of leaned into my voice. And, like, so when our show came out, I was like, well, this show is not... It's not cool, you know, but Carolyn kept saying, you know, no, it's, I love this show. It's really good. And I was like, well, maybe she knows. And she's like, we just have to, people are going to find it. Anyway, well, maybe you should ask another question again, because here I go again. I'm on my tributaries and pituitaries right now.
No. You actually touched on something exactly that I wanted to ask about, which is the notion of the reality of HBO actually backing you.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear about like, your experience in your career of like, you know, the idea of hearing so much of like, we can't wait to support you.
Right.
Like people who are so excited to eventually support you.
Yeah.
And it's like, pay me now then. Like,
and they did.
And I wanted to hear about like, what has your experience been like of people being like, oh, can't wait to support you. And, but maybe just being like in that constant purgatory place of like, what does that mean when you're not actually doing anything for me?
That's how I felt.
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like, it's so, to such a degree that I remember in the early days, like, people were coming to my show and all the time, just like, wow, you know. And like, I felt like everybody wanted me to be their best kept secret.
Yeah.
You know?
And oh, like, yeah.
And I was like, well, can you just pass, you know, slip a note across the desk and tell somebody else, you know, like, help me.
Yeah, you're
help
the people me. Who knows people.
Yeah.
But and, help me.
And you mentioned Adam / you know, Ad Rock. You know, he was a founding member of the Tender Moments,
yep,
and he's
yep.
currently on sabbatical, but he was really instrumental in inviting people to the show. Like, he put his, you know, the money where his mouth is. And
yeah.
like, he even got us to LA. Like, I had nothing, no money, like got us to LA so we could play Largo, and all these people came. And, you know, it's that kind of thing that eventually changed my life, because, you know, I go and I have a meeting with HBO with Casey Bloys and Amy Gravitt, and they were like, you know, we love you. We're excited mm-hmm. about you. And we pitched a pilot with them originally that didn't go. It ended up going to Amazon. But then they came back when that didn't go with a holding deal, which, you know, is like when they basically book you for a year.
And yeah,
like,
we reserve the right
we
to
reserve
you.
The right. And that is what it took, right? Like, so I called Carolyn Strauss, who's one of the smartest people in Hollywood, who I'd met through Michael Patrick King, who's been another very, another one of those people helping me, like put me in a Sex and the City movie, did a show with me at Ars Nova called At Least It's Pink, like really has fostered my, has taught me, has helped me, has nurtured me. And he's the one that introduced, he's like, I think you should know Carolyn. Mm-hmm. Like, who are these people? Who sends him from the heavens? And like, he's like, and he thought it would be good for me. He just wanted me to. Now, who knew that when he introduced me to her, that she was going to change my life?
Isn't it amazing when you realize that you've met people? Because, like, you can get so used to, I feel like, that sort of performance of goodwill. Like, we can't wait to support you, that kind of thing. And then, like, they don't. But they, like, are always happy to see you. But then, like, you meet the people who really deliver for you. And, like, this is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Like, and to meet, like, to meet executives who are like, oh, my God, I trust you.
Yeah.
And you want me. And you're going to make this really good. Like,
yeah.
Oh, wow. You're a unicorn.
Well, it's true. And I feel like there is a level of care that comes from the HBO side. Like, obviously, they want to have good programming, that it's a business, they want to run a successful, you know, platform. But what has kind of surprised me mm-hmm. is, like, how much of me they wanted. You know, like, I feel like, and I kind of still can't get over it.
Yeah.
I kind of can't believe also that the themes of this show resonate with other people. Because I have kind of felt, in a way, like Sam does, kind of like adrift in a lot of ways. Like, sort of like my own kind of island, wanting to connect with people, wanting to feel special, wanting to know that there's value in my contributions. Mm-hmm. Like that, Sam and I connect on that very basic level.
Yeah.
And I had no idea that that would make an interesting TV show. I mean, I guess that is kind of at the core at a lot of things, at a lot of TV shows is people wanting to be loved.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I guess I just thought in the way that we were telling it, like the slow sort of
steps. Very naturalistic.
Very naturalistic, but you know, I was just taking a pass on a scene last night. I'm sitting in my hotel room. You know, we're just tossing around ideas for season three. Should we be so lucky? And I'm just like sitting on the couch crying, you know, because it's like there's still a part of me that's like sort of not understanding that I'm actually doing this show at all. And you're just sort of there with your computer and you're writing stuff out. And, well, I would say it like this and I bet Trisha would say it like that.
Yeah.
And then, like, keep writing until I start crying. I'm like, that's probably it. Send.
Yeah. Okay. Whoa. We tapped in. I'm going to send that one off. That feels like I've refined the idea.
Or until I, like, start giggling. Yeah. And I'll, like, call Carol. And I'm like, this is stupid, right? This is dumb. And she starts giggling. And I'm like, all right, well, let's send it over to Paul and Hannah and see what they think.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Our guest is Bridget Everett. She's the star of the HBO series Somebody Somewhere.
When you were talking about, you know, working with the HBO team and the show creators, like, and the invitation for more of you, I wanted to hear about that, you know, for somebody who has made a career out of more, out of sort of the biggest possible with, like, your stage shows and with, the you know, Bridget Everett and the Tender Moments and just, like, body sort of fearless presentation.
Yeah, but that more is, like, plunging necklines.
Yes.
Beaver tails going at full speed. You know, that's that kind of more.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I wanted to, I was lucky to have Eureka O'Hara on Feeling Seen. And one of the things that we talked about with sort of how she moves through the world, she was like, you know, the thing I think about constantly is how much space I take up in the world. She's over 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
She's big as life. And she is constantly having to think of the world in terms of, like, how do I get comfortable in a space that's not physically or, like, existentially built for me?
Yeah.
And with sort of bigness being such a part of your persona, but then wanting the smaller, perhaps quieter things to be pulled from you as well to add to a more fuller picture of the idea of more Bridget, I wanted to hear from you about, like, what does that allow you to do when you are invited to be the most or more of you? When you're already so used to being so big in certain ways all the time.
Well, I think that some, you know, it's that bigness to me, like it was a long time to feel like to create kind of something on stage that was all about like, I'm big, deal with it. You know? And also hoping that people saw with my comfortability on stage in my body in that way, that it would somehow sort of unlock them a little bit, you know? But it's also probably a defense because I'm like, well, people like that, but they're not going to like what they see underneath.
Totally, yeah.
You know, they're not going to want this. Who wants this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like in some ways, it's like when my friends would move on to a romantic relationship, maybe I took it personally. Like I wasn't enough. Like I wasn't holding their interest or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it does take a toll. That becomes part of your fabric too. And you start to internalize it in every way. So when I moved to New York, I guess I'm just sort of thinking about now. It's like, I guess I just moved there and like, it's like, well, maybe you'll love this part of me, you know, love the big one that can, you know, laugh alongside herself and try to make you feel good. You know, I think that, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think you did. No, I think you did. And that leads me to ask about like, is what came first for you when you started doing a lot of live on stage work? Did confidence lead you or did performance of confidence lead to a generation of confidence within you?
I feel like it has to be the second, the latter, because the confidence catches up to me when I'm like 2.5 songs in.
Yeah.
You know, like it happens every time I come out, I sing, you know, right before I go on stage, I'm like, what am I doing? Why do I do this? Like, but I know that I'm good at it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't keep signing up for it.
Yeah.
But it's the day of that I've just, it's like this sort of self kind of like, I don't know, maybe I'm just shoring up energy. And the way I do that is by sort of giving myself a talking to, which is totally unhealthy. But then, to come out on stage, you know, I do the opening number. I'm kind of looking around. I'm like, why are you here? Why are you here? Why are you here? And then I sing the second song and I'm like, I know why you're here.
Yeah.
And the third song, sit down. I got some more to say. You know?
Yeah. Don't you think you're going anywhere?
Yeah. And I do. And I feel like the show, as much as I want it to transform other people, I feel like it does that for me every single time. And I feel like if I didn't have that, I don't know where I would be. Not like everybody has their thing that's going to sort of keep picking them up and pushing them forward.
Yeah.
And for me, it's these shows in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It feels like I can really let it rip. And it's like, I can be the person who's too much. I can be the big, you know, the big tits flopping around. I can do all that, but people love it.
Yeah. People love it.
But then, you know, there's like that famous movie star who says like, well, they want to go to bed with blah, 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 but do they want to wake up with so-and-so? You know, like, like it's, I'm not saying I want to take anybody home from my show. I'm just meaning like, but what if they saw the real me? But mm-hmm. they're, when I do my shows at Joe's Pub in New York, I do it with my band. It's a little different than the show I do on the road. But I stop and, you know, we tell, like, I do more stories and I, like...
Yeah, spoken word.
It gets more personal. And I allow people to see more of me. And, you know, I do, like, a whole song and a story and ballad. And then, you know, I got a stand ovation in the middle of the show after doing that because I think people appreciate seeing the tender underbelly.
Yeah. You know? The tender moment.
Yeah, literally the tender moment. And I, you know, they were like standing there clapping. I'm like, oh, that's because I'm on TV. And I'm like, it's not because I'm on TV. It's because, Jesus, Bridget. Like, they just enjoyed that. And like,
stealing defeat from the jaws of victory here.
And as long as I've been doing this, you know, sometimes, and it did it make me, you know, I felt very emotional in that moment because I was like, just stop doing this to yourself.
Yeah.
You know, listen to them. They're listening to you. Now you listen to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Has it been a process of getting, like when you say like, no, Bridget, they're here because they like it.
Yeah.
They enjoy it. Has listening to the crowd in that way and then listening to yourself in turn in the positive reinforcement sense, has that gotten easier over the years? Or do you find it still like, I've got to keep checking myself to remind myself. I've got to fight the sort of inside voice that tells me like, no, they accidentally stumbled in.
No, I think it's gotten easier. I think that of course, there's like the backslide of the pandemic and then doing a show of where you sort of talk about like your most personal, you know, those things have kind of played a number on me. I just sort of was talking to somebody the other night and I was like, I feel like I'm like finally coming out of this like depression, you know, maybe it was a pandemic. I was like, was it the pandemic or is it like for the last 4 years working on all these scripts in this show and doing interviews and talking about things mm-hmm. that are like personal and painful. Maybe that sort of that lingers with me throughout the day.
Yeah, you know? That would be completely fair. Coming on the back of lockdowns.
Yeah,
like, I'm gonna come out of lockdowns and really mind my pain.
And you know, and like, and sort of thinking about like, cause you know, my sister has passed away and like, mm-hmm. and I didn't really grieve her properly, mm-hmm. I suppose. And so doing the show, it's sort of like living with that every day. And then like, you know, just sort of, I don't know, not having the release of the live shows because we just didn't really do them to kind of pick me back up. And it's not like I should need to do a show to feel good. It just, there's just a supercharge you get from it that you can't really get anywhere else. And when you've been getting that for 10 years and it just sort of goes away, or 15 years, you're just like, okay.
All right.
I guess I'll watch another episode of Bake Off and see if that does the trick.
Well, it's just mild, polite show and see how that puts me back together again.
We'll be back in just a second. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Instead of scrolling mindlessly, engage mindfully with the NPR app. With a mix of on-demand news, stories from this station, and your favorite podcast, you can relax without shutting off your brain. Download the NPR app today.
The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
Diablo 4.
Final Fantasy 16.
Street Fighter 6.
Baldur's Gate 3.
Starfield.
Spider-Man 2.
Master Detective Archives Rain Code for Nintendo Switch? No, is that just me?
It's a huge time for video games.
You need somebody to tell you what's good, what's not so good, and what's amazing.
I'm Jason Schreier.
I'm Maddie Myers.
And I'm Kirk Hamilton. We're the hosts of Triple Click, a video game podcast for anyone who likes games.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
I'm Jesse Thorne. We're listening to Jordan Cruciola's interview with Bridget Everett.
And so moving toward the end of the conversation, like a thing I wanted to come back to was like when we were talking about like being on stage and like the, like you said, the surge that comes from that. And yes, the validation that comes from that. And you were like, maybe I shouldn't need this. But what it provides for me is something vital to expression and to maybe sort of like processing and dealing with life. And then, you know, I think an important thing that happens in that we see in season one of Somebody Somewhere is walking into the church for the first time. And it's like, no. Get me out of here. Yeah. I can't be in a place like this. And I wanted to talk about the construction of salvation for oneself, mm-hmm. like in the way Sam has allowed places that carry the implication of a belief or a lifestyle that she doesn't subscribe to, like going into a church and then finding such a home, singing in this place with these strangers that become a family for her. I wanted to hear about in your own life, you know, constructing salvation out of perhaps unconventional places or people or locations that allow for you to have that sort of like spiritual reconnection and nourishment that we see like stereotypically in the notion of church. But what has that been like for you?
Well, I think it has to happen on accident. It has to happen because if I'm like ever told about something, or you know, like in the way in which Sam walks into that church and like, you know, Joel's kind of knocked her off her axis, you know, and like sort of, so she kind of goes somewhere reticently. Is that the right use of that word?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And then sort of accidentally being taken by the moment. Like that's kind of how things have evolved for me, and it can happen most easily for me. Like, you know, when I came to New York and I met my friend Zach when I was looking for this guy that I had a brief, you know, whirlwind, really, you know, thing with. Anyway, but the upside of that was I met my friend Zach, and he like took me to a show, and he took me to see Kiki and Herb for the first time, and just like everything he was doing was kind of like just sort of walking me into it, mm-hmm. kind of just like no big deal, mm-hmm. like kind of a surprise. And for me, everything kind of just has to pop up, because otherwise I'll overanalyze and I'll just be like, well, and I'll tell myself the ways in which I'm not going to like it,
uh-huh.
or the way it's not going to benefit me, or the way it's going to, I guess I constantly live in fear, which doesn't really make sense if you see me as a performer, but I just constantly sort of am afraid of getting hurt. In whatever way that might be. So I just sort of have to be like, well, let's do this.
Yeah.
My friends know.
Yeah.
They know, like, they want me to do something, and we'll try this. You know, it's almost a joke. I'm sure they all joke about it on the side. just sort of bring her. Don't say anything. Just do it.
She'll thrive, but just don't tell her about it.
Just don't.
Yeah. Let it always be a surprise party for Bridget.
Yeah, and what a... You know, that's got to be a lot of missed opportunities for myself. But, you know, we get where we need to go when we get there. And I'm not really in any Rush. I'm happy. I'm happy enough.
Considering the opportunities that you have seized and that you have made for yourself, I can't imagine how you could have jammed more seizing of opportunities into your story to have made more of. I mean, my God, like, you've created a force of nature just from whole cloth.
When you put it that way, that's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
I think we've hit our hour mark. So,
well,
I
just want to say something for the people at home, and I hope you keep this, because your colleague got whisked away to jury duty, and you just did all this, you know, by the seat of your pants. And, like, I don't know how much prep time you have, but what great questions and what thoughtful engagement, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No, I so appreciate you, and I loved your episode of Feeling Seen. When your name was thrown out, there was like, oh, I get to talk to Bridget again? Like, I was especially nervous about it, not because of the short prep time, but because it was like, but I had so much fun the last time. It has to be at least as good. And I wanted to be able to live up to what I enjoyed so much the first time. So it has been an honor to discuss this all with you.
Well, thank you. This has been what a great start to the day.
Bridget Everett, her TV show, Somebody Somewhere, is absolutely wonderful. It is such a great show. You can watch both seasons of it on HBO. Also, huge thanks to Jordan Cruciola for stepping up and interviewing Bridget on short notice. I had jury duty. What can I say? I was over at the old criminal courthouse in downtown Los Angeles. Jordan Cruciola's show is Feeling Seen. As we have mentioned before, it's a chance for guests to talk about the first time they saw themselves in a movie character. Bridget was on Jordan's show one time. It was a really great conversation. And she picked the character Rudy from the movie Rudy. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. At our office, our colleague Marissa saw a car drive all the way onto the sidewalk and knock over an iron fence. But everybody was fine. No one injured, except the fence. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellows at Maximum Fun are Tabitha Myers and Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Dan just texted me a photograph of my business card from when this whole show was a one-man operation in my apartment in Koreatown. Our theme song is by The Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation, thanks to them and to Memphis Industries, their label. Bullseye is on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Find us there, follow us. We will share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.